Hello, I'm Simon Lambert of This Is Money. And in this first episode of two special This Is Money investing podcasts, I am joined by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct to help listeners through the investing maze and give them an easy to understand guide to getting started. Now, while headlines about shares soaring or crashing may make the stock market sound like something of a roller coaster, over the long term, it has proven to be the best way to beat inflation and grow your wealth. But how do you know when the time is right to start investing? What are the things to consider when working out what investments might suit you? And do you need to wait until you're richer before you become an investor? We're going to be talking about all of that. And then in a second episode, we'll discuss how to use your investments to improve the world and make a profit as we explore the world of socially responsible investing, what that means, how you can do it, how to make it fit with your investing style and appetite for risk. But for this first episode, it's all about the basics of investing. Rob Morgan, you are Charles Stanley Direct's investment analyst. You've spent two decades working in the investment industry. Over that time, you've witnessed how investing in the stock market can beat the returns on cash, which, let's face it, aren't particularly great at the moment. But you've also seen three proper stock market crashes during your career, haven't you? And arguably, we're still experiencing one of those. So why would you say to people that they should invest? And what would you say to those, more importantly, who would argue, I'm sorry, it's just too much like gambling?
Yeah, hi, Simon. It's a conversation I have a lot with friends of mine in terms of equating investing with gambling. And I would say that, the shorter you invest for, the more close to gambling it actually is. Because if you invest for a day, say, it's more or less a flip of a coin whether you make money, and the same for a week or a month. But when you start extending that horizon out, then the chances of making money on the stock market, and certainly outpacing cash as well, is very much increased. So the probability of beating cash based on sort of historic data over 2 years is something approaching 70%. If you extend that up to 10 years, it's closer to 90%. So the longer you leave your money in the market, the more it is investing, and the shorter is gambling. And the reason to leave your money in assets and the stock market is to grow it so you can spend more of it in the future. That's simply what it's all about. And that's how investing can help you reach your goals, whether that's a house purchase or more comfortable retirement. And it's a proven way of doing so, provided you invest for the long term. Although, if in the short term, cash is a safe place, and that's important to remember.
We often hear talk about investing for the long term and why you should do so, and you've explained that very well with the statistics there. But I think one of the things that often doesn't get talked about is, why should the stock market go up over time? Why should the stock market deliver good returns over time? I mean, it's not just a sort of natural phenomenon like day follows night. It's to do with the fact that the companies are taking within a stock market that make up that individual stock market, they're taking money and they're putting it to productive use. And as they put it to productive use, they can either reward their shareholders through a rising share price or dividends. And is that the reason why we should go, okay, well, if we are going to invest, investing should give us a better return than cash?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Companies have the tendency to grow over time. Certainly the right companies do. And people, I think, pick up on the news headlines quite often, which does tend to be focused on the negative. Like when you get a stock market crash and you see a certain amount of money wiped off the stock market. And I've seen three, as you pointed out, in my time in the industry. But each time the market has bounced back from those particular occasions as things have improved and the panic has subsided. And that's you're absolutely right in terms of the reason is the growth of companies. I mean, if we look at the around the world at the moment, the most dominant stock market is in the US. And we're seeing huge levels of growth from the large technology companies. So if you invested in those 10 years ago or more, then you'd have done very well. And it's easy to understand why those companies have grown so rapidly. And we don't know what the future is going to hold. That's the whole point of the stock market. we only ever deal in possibilities and not certainties. But if you believe in the power of industry to make money over the longer term, that's why you should invest in the market and see volatility, market crash, as an opportunity. In terms of my very first experience of stock market investing, in 1999, I remember buying a share in a IPO, initial public offering, and I didn't know what I was doing. I just basically decided that I was going to invest in this particular company for whatever reason. But of course, that was around the sort of dot-com bubble, and that few hundred pounds that I invested went on to become sort of around £2,500 or something like that. And then I gradually watched it go back down to almost zero from that point. And that was sort of the most sort of formative experience of my investing life. It's okay, I'm not a stock picking genius. I'm going to diversify. I'm not going to that one individual company. But it just goes to show that the market does have different moods from time to time. But if you invest for the very long term and you're buying enough slices of enough different companies and spreading your risk, then you will, I believe, make good returns in the longer term.
We're going to go more into details of what types of investment might be right for those who are starting out, or just those who want to sit back and grow their wealth and not really worry too much about what they're doing later on in the podcast. But I think you touch on an important point there, or two important points, really. Firstly, three market crashes in that period of time. It's, what, 20 years? I mean, would you expect three big crashes in 20 years? Maybe. It's been a fairly eventful 20 years. And people look at the stock market that we talk about in the UK, FTSE 100, and they can say, well, look at its level now. Look at its level at the peak in 1999. That stock market's gone nowhere in 20 years. Yet you tell me investing is a long-term game. But there's a very important element that would have come from buying into that stock market and holding onto it, even if you had just simply followed the market. And that's something called dividends, isn't it? Which is companies delivering a payout to people. And if you take those into account, actually, you would be comfortably up over that period. But secondly, if you only invested in the FTSE 100, you're not really investing right, are you? You need to be putting your eggs into many more baskets than just the leading stock market index of one country.
Yeah, and I think that's especially relevant today because the FTSE 100 isn't particularly diversified in terms of the sectors. It's overweight in things like mining and energy. You get a much better representation of the stock markets around the world by going beyond the FTSE 100. And absolutely, you're right. In terms of the returns from the FTSE 100, they haven't been, certainly in capital terms, we're actually no better off today than we were 20 years ago. It seems remarkable to say that, but 20 years ago, of course, it was the dot-com bubble, which caused the explosion in internet-related shares and the subsequent collapse. So that would have been a particularly poor time to get involved. And actually, if you look at the last 10 years, your returns from the FTSE 100 would have averaged actually over 7% a year. But clearly, in the first decade of this century, we had actually a period where stock market returns weren't particularly good because we had the internet bubble crash, and then we had the financial crisis of 2007-2008. But, you know, throughout that, if you'd kept invested and kept reinvesting your dividends, you still would have made a decent return. You know, even if you'd invested at the peak in a diversified enough, even a UK portfolio, you still would have made some money and you probably would have beaten cash as well. So I would say, yes, by all means, be skeptical of the dangers, but don't spend too long thinking about the wider issues of the world. And quite often you make the best money when everyone else is panicking or pessimistic. And the other point about sort of diversification, there's huge opportunities beyond the UK. So I do think it's important to, you know, set up your investments so you're trying to harness all of those as much as possible.
So we've talked about the things that you might be able to invest in, but for those who are starting out and thinking, okay, all right, I'd like to get a bit more on my money than the 0.5% my bank's paying me in interest, if I'm lucky. But how do they know if they're ready to invest? Because this is something that comes up a lot, and we hear from readers, from listeners, is I would like to invest, but I don't think I'm ready yet. What is ready to invest? What does that even mean?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the first decision is going to be whether or not to start investing. And, you know, clearly if household finances are stretched and putting money aside is difficult, then the capacity to afford the potential losses that are involved in stock market investing it's not going to be appropriate. Generally, people would say that to save up a cash reserve is sort of your first line of defense against anything, you know, going wrong in your life. And I think we've seen this obviously recently with events surrounding coronavirus, that, you know, unexpected events can crop up and you need some kind of cash buffer to see you through, whether that's 3 months or 6 months expenditure. That's a sensible thing to do, but keeping too much money in cash can be a wasted opportunity, because as you point out, interest rates at the moment are very low and they're unlikely to get better, even if we get a bit of inflation coming through. So build up your cash buffer, certainly ensure that short-term debt, such as personal loans, overdrafts, credit cards are repaid, because the returns that you're going to get on an investment aren't likely to actually overcome the level of high interest debt. So you've got to have that paid off as well. So they're the prerequisites. But after you've done that and you've built up your cash reserve, then that's the time to start building your investments up.
So you've got that cash buffer built up. You've got the money there in case you lose your job or one of those life events that hits your finances comes into play. The boiler packs up, the clutch goes on the car, the kind of thing that usually only happens at the worst possible time for it to happen. And then you're looking at the rest of your savings and thinking, well, actually, I'd like to earn a bit more money on it. Now, do you need to keep building up until you've got a nice big lump sum so you're rich before you start to invest and then you invest all of that? Or is it actually better to start with a little and often?
Yeah, that's going to depend on your particular circumstances. And certainly if you've got a lot of money, there's no reason why you couldn't go in with a lump sum. But it is certainly a myth that you need to start with a large amount of money. And actually, there's a number of advantages associated with building up gradually. You know, you can start small, and even a few hundred pounds or £50 a month will add up over time. So the advantages of doing this, well, a lump sum puts more of your money to work at an earlier stage, so you've got longer for it to work. And generally speaking, if the markets are rising, then that's a better thing to do. But if you are worried about volatility, the ups and downs of the stock market and other assets, then putting money aside on a monthly basis, on a regular basis, can be a really good way of taking that out of the equation. Because if the assets fall in value, the money that you're putting in will buy more of them as those prices go down. And as long as they recover and you've given them enough time to recover and go higher over time, then you can actually make more money that way. It's what's known as pound cost averaging. In a rising market, then you'd be better off, you know, just putting a lump sum in. But if you're investing little and often, that does average out things and take away some of the volatility. And it's amazing how much a small amount can add up over time. So if you're doing £200 a month over 10 years at a growth rate of 5%, you can get to £30,000, roughly speaking. So the compounding of returns has a greater effect the longer you invest for. And the earlier you start, the better from that perspective. That's how you can get started with a small amount.
I think people are often actually quite surprised at how small an amount, if they start investing monthly, they can start off with a DIY investing platform, aren't they? They think that it's going to be in the hundreds of pounds, but sometimes it can just be 50 or something.
Absolutely. With an online platform, you know, the minimums are very low and it's very easy to get set up from your phone or your laptop or whatever and keep tabs on it.
So one of the things that anybody considering investing will hear a lot about if they start reading around the subject, listening to podcasts like this, listening to any so-called expert, is they'll keep hearing this little word, risk, 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 which sounds dangerous to people. They hear risk and they think, oh, hang on a minute, are we back to that gambling thing that we were talking about earlier? But I mean, we take risks every day of our lives, don't we? You know, crossing the road is a risk. But when people are talking about investment risk, what exactly is it that they tend to be talking about? And how do people think about how much risk they're happy to take, and therefore what sort of investments might suit them?
Yes, I mean, risk is definitely a sort of nebulous term. I mean, risk to me would be sort of the permanent loss of capital. Certainly, you know, if you're investing in the short term, that actually increases your risk, because if you know you've got to take the money out in 1 week or 1 month or 6 months, then, you know, your risk of permanent loss of your capital is, as we discussed earlier, relatively high, you know, the shorter time scale you go to. So what investors do to sort of mitigate risk and the different types of risk is to spread their money around. Risk can be about the permanent loss of capital, but the smaller number of investments that you have, the greater that risk actually is. So if you invest in one share, like the share I bought in 1999, then the risk I was taking was obviously far too high. If I'd bought 5 shares or 10 shares, then that would have spread the risk. But probably, knowing me at the time, I'd have bought all of the hot technology stocks because I didn't know any better.
That was exactly what I was about to say. It's just, it's anybody listening to this, diversification and spreading your risk does not just involve buying 5 companies that do exactly the same thing.
No, exactly right. So if I had bought 5 or 10 shares that were spread across different industries, then I might have been onto something much better. Risk is inherent. And obviously the other way to flip it around really is investing is being paid to take risk in a way. And sometimes you're paid very well to take risk, and sometimes you're not, depending on what the valuation of those assets actually are. But the way to actually control risk is through having lots of different things, and that's what we call diversification. And getting the balance of risk and return is the very difficult thing to do. But it's what you need to do to control the level of ups and downs in the portfolio that you have. And if you take too little risk, of course, you put in all in cautious investments, you're not necessarily going to meet your goals. You need to take some risk to reach those goals.
And is this a part of investing where people, instead of looking at the investments themselves, need to actually start from the position of looking at themselves, the investor, and thinking about, okay, well, if I look at my ISA one day and the portfolio is down by 30%, how am I going to feel about that? How am I going to react? And also things like, how long am I investing for? Am I investing because I want this pot of money in 5 years? Am I investing because I want it in 10 years? Or am I just investing because I plan to invest over the rest of my working life and grow my wealth? That can then help you decide where on a sliding scale of riskier investments you might want to put your money.
That's absolutely right. Risk is personal. As I said, taking too little risk is a risk in itself, because if you're in your 20s, say, and you're putting money into a pension, say, for the very longer term for retirement, then being too cautious really constrains the returns and the importance of compounding of those returns over time. It's a wasted opportunity to do that. But if you're only a few years from drawing on your money, then you wouldn't necessarily want to take much risk at all, if any. So that's where you have to position yourself on that sliding scale. And it's not an exact science, but you know, we would say, generally speaking, invest for 5 years plus, and anything less than that, you're going to be in much better off being cautious and being in very low risk investments or cash. But if you're young, if you're saving regularly in particular, there's nothing wrong with having your entire investment portfolio in the stock markets, because you're giving yourself that length of time. And yes, you might get a 30% downturn in the market, as we've seen, but you're giving yourself sufficient years, in fact, decades, for that to bounce back over time. So it's very dependent on timescales. And the longer you have, the more you can afford to go high risk.
You alluded to it there with the talk of being sort of, you know, potentially entirely invested in the stock market. A lot of the time when you talk to people, they think of investing as shares, as the stock market. But it's not just that, is it? There are other assets you can buy. And the main other asset that people hold in order to try to control, mitigate maybe is a better word, the risk that they are taking are bonds, aren't they? So could you explain to listeners what the difference is between a share and a bond, and why those two things are considered to have different levels of risk?
Yes, absolutely. And people do tend to equate investing with the stock market, as you say. And you know, that tends to be a good engine of returns, because as we mentioned earlier, you're buying a slice of business. You're a part owner of a business when you buy shares, also known as equities, and they pay you hopefully a dividend each year if they make a profit. And over time, you harness the growth in that organization. The fortunes of your investment intrinsically linked to that. Bonds are different entirely because you're lending to a business rather than actually taking a stake in it. So you own the debt of that business. And in return for that capital that you're giving to the business, you receive a coupon or an income each year or each month in some cases. It tends to be more stable. And certainly if you're lending to very secure companies, or even in the case of government bonds to governments, they tend to be very, very low risk indeed, but to the point that you don't get a particularly good return from them. But the point is that you've got a lot more certainty as a bond investor, because you know what your income payments are going to be over time, and if all goes well, and you know what your payment at the end is when they pay their capital. So they tend to be fairly stable investments, but obviously that depends on the credit quality of the issuer. So large, diverse companies tend to be very secure, but they pay a lower amount of income. You can also lend to much riskier businesses that pay a high level of income. But the point of using bonds and equities is they tend to do different things. If the stock market is going up, then bonds, particularly secure bonds, don't tend to be doing as well, and vice versa. And that comes back to sort of diversification, described as the only free lunch in investing. You can lower your risk without compromising returns by the same extent by using the two.
And we saw this recently, didn't we, in the coronavirus market crash, where stock markets around the world sold off very, very heavily as countries went into lockdown. Investors went, whoa, hang on a minute, this isn't bad news. And a wave of money shifted back into what are considered to be safer assets, i.e. high quality government bonds, US bonds, UK bonds, German bonds. So if you had had that mix of bonds and shares in your portfolio, any mix of those high quality bonds and shares, whilst your shares would have been falling, your bonds would have been going up in value and acting as something of a counterweight, putting the brakes on the car as it careered down the road, I suppose, would be one way of talking about it.
That's right. Yeah, it certainly would have reduced the volatility that you've experienced in that period. And of course, you can take those opportunities to rebalance as well. So you can sell some areas that have been doing well and top up areas that have been doing badly to maintain sort of right level of balance, which is an opportunity to try and increase your returns over time. But yeah, absolutely. And we have seen with the coronavirus that, you know, investors who have lent too far in one direction and not diversified their portfolios particularly well have come out of the situation obviously worse off than people who've had a good mix of assets.
To get back to our message of simplicity, for anybody who opens up an account with an investing platform, looks at all the different investments on offer and feels it's all just a bit confusing, how do they know what to buy? What kind of investment is the kind of investment that might suit a beginner or someone who just wants to sit back and grow their wealth?
Yeah, absolutely. There's loads of different options and lots of investors buy individual shares. But I would hasten to add, if you're going to do that, you need to dedicate the time and research. And that's not for the uninitiated. Fortunately, there's much simpler ways of getting involved and getting invested. And the two I would highlight there are passive or tracker funds, which are basically designed to replicate the performance of a particular stock market index. So they own lots and lots of different slices of the companies that make up the FTSE 100, or in the US, the S&P 500. So you own automatically own slices of all those companies making up the index. And they tend to be very low cost. And what they will give you is more or less the performance of that particular stock market index. That can be a great way of starting off, because you're getting the performance of the stock market, you're getting low charges, and you're getting a good spread of investments in those underlying indices. And the other thing I would highlight, if you want to diversify further and you don't just want to be invested in the stock market, is multi-asset funds. Again, I should probably explain what funds are. They basically will hold for you, the investor, lots and lots of different shares or other assets as well. And in the case of multi-asset funds, you buy just one fund and you can own not only shares, but also bonds and other assets as well. It might be property or other things like gold. That gives you a diversified portfolio in just one investment that's really easy to buy for a small amount. The manager of that particular investment fund picks the areas as well as the underlying investments. So for a certain amount of risk, you can choose a portfolio that sort of suits your requirements. If you're more cautious, you can go for a cautious one, or if you're more adventurous, you can go for one that's more oriented towards the stock market. But the principle is the same. It's a broad portfolio in a single fund, and that's ideal for investors with smaller amounts of money to spend.
So this is a very easy way of not being like Rob when he first started investing, isn't it? And just buying that one share.
Yeah, that's right.
And you can get a fund that will do this with a manager, and you can get funds that do this that are just tracker funds as well, can't you? That will simply follow the market, and you can choose the percentage of shares and percentage of bonds. And that's a very easy way to invest, presumably.
That's a very, very easy way to invest. And it can be completely hands-off. Certainly, if you pop a lump sum in and then set up a direct debit, you could be buying it, you know, mechanically each month. And it doesn't really need any maintenance unless your sort of situation changes. That's why these are really popular investments, and for good reason.
Does it also represent an easy way to get started investing, to choose an investment like that? You can start getting your money in, start building up your investment pot, and then you might discover that actually you're just happy to sit back, keep paying your money in and hopefully watching your wealth grow over time. Or you might think, well, you know, as we do with things when we start doing them, actually, I'm getting a bit interested in this. Maybe I might like to buy some other investments. Can you then start getting a bit more interested in other stuff and maybe saying, actually, I think that particular part of the world or that particular part of the economy, that particular sector might start doing well and start branching out into things that you've chosen yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the beauty of having an online platform like Charles Stanley Direct, because you can start simple or you can make it more complex as your knowledge grows. So if you want to buy an individual share, or if you want to invest in a certain part of the world, then you'll be able to do that. The possibilities are endless. There is almost too much choice, but you can tailor your own portfolio to your own level of knowledge and what you want to achieve. So if you do want to invest in a certain part of the world, there's going to be options available to you. There's going to be funds that invest in those particular areas, possibly quite niche and high risk areas, and you should know about the risks when doing so. But yeah, I mean, there's something like over 3,000 funds out there, which is quite amazing. So there is an investment to suit every taste. As your knowledge grows and your interest grows in it, and we find that quite a lot of people start simple but then go on to making their own judgments more and more and more and get more sophisticated as they go along. keeping in mind, obviously, the rules of keeping diversified and keeping to the risk level that they're happy with. But there's lots and lots of choices, and you're not limited by geography. If you want to buy into Japan, if you want to buy into Europe, if you want to buy a technology fund, you know, there's going to be options there for you.
But if you keep that core of your portfolio as being the broadest possible thing and then add these bits in smaller chunks, then you're mitigating the risk that you might suddenly discover that you're actually overwhelmingly invested in Japan, like you said, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a danger that you sort of turn into a kind of a stamp collector, and that you end up with a kind of collection of things that you've built up over time without any kind of sort of rationale. So you've always got to keep in mind, what's my objectives? And a good way to do that is to have a core of the portfolio that's kind of just always there, that you're very happy with, and perhaps with some, you know, additional things that you're interested in, or you've got a particularly strong feeling about around the edges of that. That's quite a nice approach for doing it, because it you know, allows you to sort of express yourself in a way and research areas and get interested in certain areas, but without forgetting about the importance of having a stable backbone of the portfolio and a decent amount of diversification in that.
Okay, now before we wrap up this episode, there is one other thing that we need to talk about and touch on, which is that it's not just about investing, it's also about what's often referred to as the wrapper around your investments. And the one that most people will have heard of is an ISA, a stocks and shares ISA. What's the point of investing in a stocks and shares ISA rather than just opening an account and investing? What are the benefits, and should you always do it if you can?
Yeah, it's generally a good idea to prioritize tax-efficient ways of holding your investments. And an ISA is a really important way of doing that, because you don't tend to cut down on your investment options at all, but you hold them in a tax-efficient way. What do I mean by that? It's a wrapper around those investments. So it's an account where any gains that you make on your investments aren't subject to capital gains tax, and any income that you pay that's paid to you doesn't count for income tax purposes. So think of it as a sort of perfectly legal personal tax haven for your investments. There's a limit each year that you can pay in, but besides that, there's few limits in terms of how you can use them. You can also transfer cash ISA, which is, you know, what people commonly use ISAs for, into a stocks and shares ISA and vice versa. So you could use a cash ISA that you've built up as well. We'd definitely say use an ISA rather than not, because keeping your money out of the clutches of the tax man might not seem relevant in the shorter term if you're not a higher earner. But as your wealth grows, it might become more and more relevant, which is why people often describe the ISA allowances as valuable. We should also highlight pensions, though, the other tax-efficient way of holding your investments. But certainly an ISA is really important for needs that aren't related to retirement.
And with a pension, a self-invested personal pension, or a SIP as it's often referred to, people get an extra bonus when they put their money in, don't they, in the form of some tax relief from the government. But you pay for that by not being allowed to take money out of it until a later date. It's currently 55, and that's going up to 57, I understand.
Yes, for younger listeners, it may go up beyond that. We don't know, because any subsequent government can always change the rules around pensions. There's been lots of tinkering over the years. But as it stands, they're worth considering, because the incentive of tax relief is actually really, really powerful. So when you put money into a self-invested personal pension, or SIP, or any other pension, personal pension, you're going to receive income tax relief on your contributions at your highest rate. So depending on what that is, that could be a large amount of money, certainly for higher rate taxpayers and additional rate taxpayers. That sort of helping hand from the government, I think, gets overlooked by a lot of people. But, you know, if you can put, you know, £60 in for every £100 invested, that is a powerful way of getting a real kickstart towards your retirement goals. And clearly the tax benefits do vary according to individuals, and the tax on getting your money out of the pension will come into play further down the road. But for most people, pensions are the most tax efficient way of saving towards retirement.
Okay, well, that's the basics of investing. Well done for squeezing that into one podcast episode, Rob. I'm impressed. On the next episode of this special two-parter, we're going to be discussing how to make more of your money and try to do some good with it. Socially responsible investing. It's a concept that can cover a lot of bases, from avoiding certain sectors to backing companies that promise to do better by their workers or society, or just those that are actively working to improve the environment. So tune into the next episode of this two-part series in a week's time to find out more. But remains to say, thank you for listening. And Rob, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Goodbye.